Okay, I'll start a little bit by just having a quick review here of what constructions look like. This is the second to last slide from my last lecture. So the first issue that we discussed that I actually devoted two whole lectures to was the status of syntactic categories, and argued that syntactic categories are actually roles in a construction. So these elements here are the categories, but the basic unit is the construction as a whole. The construction as a whole, of course, includes both the form in the blue boxes and the meaning and symbolic links that link the form to the meaning. We also talked about how the meaning is actually a much more complex structure than the actual elements that you find in the linguistic form. The elements in the linguistic form evoke a more complex syntactic semantic structure. Yesterday afternoon, I argued that, in fact, you should look at the syntactic structure here as only having this part-whole relationship. So you have the construction as a whole. It has particular elements as parts. Of course, these elements may themselves be constructions, complex constructions, and will have other elements as parts. But you don't have to have any relations in between elements. So that simplifies the syntactic structure. So this is basically it. The whole syntactic model can be summarized on a single slide. Part of the reason for that is because there is no set of building blocks. Remember, I criticized the building block model, so you don't have any universal categories. Of course, in any particular language, you have categories that are defined by these constructional roles, but that's implicit in this diagram. It's all the possible things that can fill this role, and so on in every construction. There are also taxonomic relations among constructions, ways to capture generalizations about the structure or function of constructions, and I'll be talking about that in much more detail on Tuesday for those of you who can stay for the remainder of the lectures. So that's the basic structure of constructions, and as I said, one important point that I made is that there aren't any universal building blocks. There's no universal syntactic categories that we should be constructing constructions out of. So you might ask, well, what about constructions themselves, these things up here? Is there a universal inventory of constructions that we can identify from one language to the next? And the answer I'm going to give is actually no. So constructions are sometimes proposed to be universal discrete structural types that can be identified cross-linguistically. This is even said by some construction grammarians. A good example of this, the one that we'll explore in this talk, is the idea of a universal passive construction. However, as I will show you today, there's good reason to believe that there are no universal constructions in structural terms. Constructions, of course, can be compared by their function. And in an earlier lecture, Randy LaPala asked me about this, and I said that, yes, you can. When you want to look at the same construction across languages, it has to be a functionally equivalent construction. And then you can ask questions about how they differ in their structural form. But this doesn't mean that the possible constructions in the world's language are just completely random. In fact, there is a syntactic space of structural possibilities, and there are universal constraints on those. At least that's what we would expect to find, and we do find this in the case of voice constructions, which is the topic of today's lecture. So we're going to go from universal constructions to a notion of a syntactic space. So the kind of constructions I'm going to talk about here are voice constructions. I'm actually not going to talk about all types of constructions that linguists call voice constructions. I'll be restricting my attention to the contrast between what is called the active and passive constructions in Western European grammatical tradition and in Western European languages. I'll also be talking about a kind of construction that typologists have discussed. It's called the inverse construction. Some of you may be unfamiliar with it because it's not something that is talked about in most linguistics textbooks. As we'll see, the paradigm example of the inverse construction is found in a Native American language family, the Algonquian family. So what you find here is, even among typologists who, as I said before, ought to know better, they still have debates about whether a construction in a particular language is really a passive construction, or really an inverse construction, or really an ergative construction. We'll see that later on. And these kind of debates are basically the same kind of debates that people have when they say, does this language really have adjectives or not? They're really, to me, pointless debates. We can't really answer that question, and even if we did, it's not really an interesting question, because the only way you can answer it is by doing what I called methodological opportunism, essentially picking out the facts that support your point and ignoring the facts that don't support your point. So we're going to take a very different view of this. We first have to come up with a cross-linguistically valid definition of voice constructions. This is actually more difficult than you think. I mean, this is part of the problem, is that when people try to say this language has a passive or it doesn't have a passive, is they don't really have a good set of cross-linguistically valid criteria to define a passive construction. So you can do it on a purely functional basis. Tammy Bivon wrote an article quite many years ago in which he pointed out that if you use the functional basis for the passive, which would be something like the patient argument is more topical than the agent argument, then you're actually going to bring in a lot of other constructions that most people don't usually call voice constructions. There's actually nothing wrong with that, and in fact there's something important about doing it that way, which I'll come to at the end of the lecture, but most people want to look at a narrower range of constructions than that. And there is a way to do this. It's what I call the derived structural definition in my typology textbook. You start from some kind of functionally defined basic voice construction. I'm going to not tell you about how I do it quite yet, but we're going to start by saying there's a basic voice construction. The most reliable, though not completely reliable, criterion is the basic voice construction is the one that occurs most frequently in the language. And once we've identified the basic voice construction, remember we're looking at this some radical construction grammar, so that we have to find the constructions, and then we define the categories or roles based on that construction. So once we identify the basic voice construction, we will use the roles for participants in that construction and say, okay, this role is a subject role, this role is the object role, and then we'll also have an oblique for things that are neither subjects nor objects, that is, things that are coded in a different way. And so again, I'm using terms like subject and object, and you might wonder, why am I using these terms? Well, I'm using them to mean a very specific thing that's different from what some other people use these terms for. It means particular role in the basic voice construction of that language. And also the verb form you find is the verb form for the role in the basic voice construction that is filled by the predicate. Okay, so these definitions are all construction specific. I mean, there's another way you can look at today's lecture. It's not just that I'm going to try to make a general point about voice constructions and syntactic constructions in general, but this will give you an example of how you would analyze a particular linguistic phenomenon in radical construction grammar. So I've made all these general statements. I've made a lot of critical arguments about how not to do it. Here's a chance for you to see how I think you should analyze a construction. Okay, so once we've identified the basic voice construction, then we can identify a non-basic voice construction. And at this point, I don't really care what you call it. I mean, right now, my interest is just to call it basic and non-basic. Some people call them active or direct, passive and inverse. And I'll use these names because that's what other people use, but do not assume at all that I think these are universal construction types. So the non-basic voice construction would be simply identified as another construction in the language. It's structurally distinct. And then what we do is we look at how it is structurally distinct from the basic voice construction. And in particular, we're going to look at how the verb is expressed. Is it in the same form as in the basic construction? And then how are the arguments, the participant roles expressed? Are they in the same form as the basic voice construction or in a different form? So for example, take English. Okay, the basic voice is the one that English grammarians call the active voice. It's illustrated in a sentence like, wolves followed us. So in this case, we have the patient. So we have two different roles, and following typological practice, I will give them labels, these letter labels. So P for patient, A for agent. And I'll call them agent and patient, but obviously their semantic definition will have to be broader than that. But we'll focus on using the prototypical members. So by definition, the way that you express the patient in the basic voice we'll call the object. So in English, that means it comes after the verb, and the pronoun has to be in the correct object form. Again, by definition, the basic verb form is the one that we find in the basic voice construction. Simple verb form, inflected. The agent, again, by definition, we're going to call that the subject role. So the subject role is the one that is found in the basic voice construction for the agent. In English, it comes before the verb. If you had a pronoun there, it would be in the proper pronoun form for subjects. English has another voice, which traditionally is called the passive voice. So this is the non-basic voice. It's actually very infrequent in language use in English, so that's good. That tells us it's non-basic. Now we can ask ourselves, what does the verb look like? What does the how is the agent expressed? How is the patient expressed? So now we see that the patient is expressed in the subject position and form. So the patient's behavior, the patient's structural properties are basically the same as the agent's structural properties there. The agent is not a subject. In fact, it is not, but it does not look like an object either because it takes this preposition. So it's an oblique. And again, we define an oblique as an argument role that does not look like the agent or patient roles in the basic voice construction. Now, the auxiliary also agrees with the patient. I'll use the term agree instead of index. I should be strict and use the term index all the time, but more people know the term agreement, so I put agree in here. So the auxiliary agrees with the patient. That's considered to be another indicator that the patient is like the subject, and in fact, if we had an agreeing verb form here, it would agree with the agent. So again, in this respect, it looks like the subject in the agent construction. And lastly, there's a special verb form, the passive participle verb form. So it's different from the basic verb form. And I'll just call it the special verb form. Now, when we look at the examples I'm going to give you in the next few pages of the next few slides, and in fact, all the slides for today's talk, you'll see I'm going to identify the structural properties of the construction, comparing it to the basic verb construction in the language. I won't always give you an example of the basic verb construction simply for reasons of space and time. The properties will be color-coded, the way it's coded on this particular slide. So what in English we call the cool colors, green and blue, will be used to code properties of the construction that look like the basic voice construction. And in particular, blue will be used for the whatever the agent and patient phrases look like. And green will be used, how is it green? Oh yeah, it's not too great, but it'll have to do. Green will be used to describe properties of the verb that look like the basic voice construction. Conversely, we'll use what we call warm colors to describe the properties that don't look like the basic voice construction. So again, red will be used to describe properties of how the agent and patient are expressed in the non-basic voice and how it, when it doesn't look like the basic voice. And orange will be used to describe properties of the verb, including its agreement properties, if it doesn't look like the basic voice. And as we'll see, you're going to get a mixture of blue and green and red and orange properties in the various non-basic voice constructions we'll see. Okay, I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture that There's this Western tradition that identifies the English passive voice, and some people have argued that there is a universal passive in the sense of, not in the functional sense that Givon had of a patient that's more topical than the agent, but in a structural sense, that there are certain structural properties of a construction, the form of the construction, that you can use to identify a passive. Well, that kind of claim only works if there's a very sharp distinction, like you see in English here, between the basic voice construction and the non-basic voice construction in terms of their structural properties. So in this case, it looks like English, well, we're using English as kind of the reference point. It's totally different from the English passive is totally different from the English active. I also mentioned that typologists have identified another construction which they were unwilling to call a passive, a non-basic voice construction. So they called this an inverse. Oh, I guess I'm not there yet, sorry. There's another factor, this is actually relevant to the inverse, which is that when we're looking at constructions, remember constructions are pairings of form and meaning. So the meaning of a voice construction is some kind of configuration of participants in an event, and of course the event itself. So we have to define a conceptual space to map the distribution of the basic and non-basic voice constructions in a language. Now, you've already actually seen a lot of conceptual spaces if you've been listening to Melissa Bowerman's talks at this lecture series. She's given many examples with things like on and in and out and off and open and break and cut, where she had little pictures showing particular spatial relations and verbal actions, and then showing how languages use particular verb forms or preposition forms or whatever to express those different combinations of those scenes. Well, I'm going to have to use something more abstract here. So this is supposed to represent scenes A is the agent argument, P is the patient argument. The numbers refer to person, so first, second, and third person. And A, first, second, and third person. So we're going to start by defining the possible combinations in terms of who is acting on whom. So this box here represents first person agent acting on second person patient. This box down here, this blank, is third person agent acting on third person patient. These boxes are grayed out because they aren't relevant. They actually have to do with reflexes. So this is first person acting on first person. You know, I shaved myself. Or second person acting on second person. Do you see yourself in the mirror? So we're only interested in the boxes that are white here. Okay, why is this particular combination of features? I'm looking at grammatical person of agent and patient in the action. Why is this relevant? Well, it's because of constructions like this other construction called the inverse. So here I actually do give you the form in the basic verb form in Cree, I see them. You'll see that I is a prefix, them, third person plural, is a suffix, and then there's another suffix on the verb form. So the basic verb form actually has a suffix on it. Now if we contrast the inverse form on the right hand side, you'll see the patient is coded like a subject, so that looks like the English passive, it's a prefix. The agent, however, is coded like an object in the basic voice construction, not like an oblique. This is why typologists balked at calling this a passive. The verb, however, is in a special form, which again is like the English one. Obviously, the labels that we give these special forms, that's what linguists give them. It's obviously not what the speakers do themselves. But the thing that really struck linguists who looked at constructions like Cree is that you don't really have much of a choice in whether you choose the active or the basic form or the non-basic form in this language. In English, at least in theory, though, if not in actual usage, you could use the agent's, the active voice or the passive voice, no matter whether agent's first person or third person and patient's second person or first person or third person or whatever. But in Cree, you can only use the direct form, the basic form, There's actually a slightly different ranking here, second and first person. If the second person is acting on first is acting on third, and also third is acting on third. If it's the other way around, you have to use the inverse. And this is usually explained in terms of a hierarchy. So second person, the addressee, is sort of the top of the hierarchy, has a top rank, and the first person's in the middle rank, and the third person is in the lower rank. So if someone in a higher rank is acting on someone in a lower rank, first person acting on third person, you use the direct form. If someone of a lower rank is acting on someone of a higher rank, third person acting on first person, then you use the inverse form. So that's why you have this distribution in the boxes here. Again, I'm using the cool color blue to represent the basic voice form and the red, the warm color red to indicate the usage of the inverse form. The only case where there's overlap is when there's third person acting on third person. Obviously, these are reflexive, so you don't have those combinations. But you could have, you know, one third person acting on another third person, and then you have both options. So there is some overlap. But most of the time, they're mutually exclusive, and it depends on the grammatical person of the agent and patient arguments. So this fact struck people very much. And that, combined with the fact that the syntax here is a little different, led linguists, both, of course, specialists in Algonquian languages and then typologists to follow up, to call this an inverse construction, a non-basic voice construction that's different from the active. Okay, now, as a number of people have noted, including in a paper by Scott DeLancey from 30 years ago, if you look at constructions which people would call passive, you get the same kind of restrictions about voice, and even if they're not categorical, you know, you have to use the form or you can't use the form, you still get differences in usage, as you find if you looked actually at how people use the passive in English. So let's consider Lummi. This is a language, a Salishan language in the northwest coast of North America. So the agent is not a subject, it takes the preposition, so that's a red box, non-basic form. The basic form is on the left there, you know the man. The verb agrees with the patient. That's what you would expect, again, for like a passive construction. So it looks less like the English passive. There's a special verb form, which Salish linguists call a passive, so that's fine. A little oddly, though, it still has a marker of transitivity, which you wouldn't expect, because most people analyze the English passive as an intransitive verb form, a subject and no object. So even though here the agent is expressed with a preposition, it's got a transitive marker. So that's, I've given that a green box, so it looks more, it does look like the basic form. It's identical to the basic form. But the other interesting fact about Lummi is that you also have a distributional pattern that is reminiscent of the pattern you found with the Cree inverse. And the thing you need to take note of here, so you've got first, second, third person pronoun, third person common noun, that's what the CN stands for, is that the active form is found in the upper right corner of this conceptual space. The passive form is found in the lower left corner of this conceptual space. So the upper right corner is where you have the highest ranked agent acting on the lowest ranked patient. The lower left corner is where you have the lowest ranked agent acting on the highest ranked patient. So the complete inverse situation. And that, as we'll see, is going to be the general pattern we're going to observe. So that's another reason why we selected these particular conceptual space, is that the basic verb form is going to be associated with the upper right corner, and the non-basic form is going to be associated with the lower left corner. What happens in between? Well, that's going to vary from language to language. In this particular language, the active is a little more widely used than it is than the inverse in Cree. Okay, so this is to show you the constructions that look more like the English passive voice construction, though not completely like it, also display this pattern in the conceptual space. And in a few examples I will show you, more versions of the same thing. But now what I'm going to do is look at things that people have called passives and describe their structural variety. So Welsh, a Celtic language spoken in Wales and Britain, has a construction that is traditionally called a passive, or sometimes called a passive. It's translated there, and he was killed by a dragon. So the agent takes a preposition, so red. However, the patient remains in its object form. This is particularly with these pronominal objects. So that makes it still look like the basic construction. So now we have a kind of mixture of properties, just like we saw in the Lumi example. Now I'm going to have to introduce another color, purple down there. The verb does not agree with either the agent or the patient. It's in an impersonal form, as it's called in the Western grammatical tradition. There you've got a, so what you're going to find here, and we're going to find this in other languages, is you're going to have things that look like the basic construction, things that don't look like the basic construction. So the stuff I'll put in red and orange are like opposed to the basic construction. And then you're going to have other structural properties that are neither like the basic construction, but they're also not the opposite of the basic construction. So we're going to think of the properties that I describe with warm colors as being an opposite of what you found in the basic construction, the properties in the cool colors. And then purple, which of course is in between red and blue, is for properties that look like they share something about the basic construction, something about the non-basic construction. Spanish. Spanish has a construction with a reflexive pronoun that is come to have passive uses. Spanish speakers will sometimes object because this is a kind of sociolinguistically salient trait. This is actually a sentence I heard, so it does happen, but some Spanish speakers who are sensitive to what is proper Spanish will deny that such sentences exist or occur. So the verb agrees with the patient, so that looks like a good non-basic property. The agent takes a preposition. What Spanish speakers object to is the presence of an agent phrase here, but as I said, it does occur. But the patient also occurs in the object form. And the reason, of course, is because this is a reflexive. And in Spanish, you express the reflexive by having both the reflexive argument as both the subject and object encoding in terms of the basic verb form, or the basic voice construction. So we again have a mixture of traits. The verb, of course, is also in the basic form. There's no special passive form here. So now we have pretty much a kind of mixture of traits, and this is why some people don't think of this as a true passive. They call it a reflexive passive. Well, this is just like calling something an adjectival verb. It's kind of a cop-out, as Macaulay said. I mean, it's true that it's not like a passive. It's not all properties are not all red and orange, but it's also not the basic verb form of the language, basic voice form of the language. Bambara, a language in West Africa. The patient is in the subject form. The agent is in the oblique form, so this looks like a good old non-basic, nice warm color properties. However, the verb is in the basic form. So it's a mixture of warm and cool properties. Another Salishan language, upriver Halkomelem. Patient is in the subject position. So you can see this in this language, the verb comes first. Subjects in the basic verb form come second. The agent comes in the opposite object position, no preposition. So now it looks more like the inverse in Cree. And now we get something that is not usually talked about in the studies of voice, but it's quite widespread in the world's languages. The verb agrees with the patient, but it uses special forms that are neither the subject agreement forms nor the object agreement forms. So the fact that the verb agrees with the patient looks like a non-basic fact, a property of the non-basic construction, voice construction, but it uses a special form that you don't find in the basic construction. So we'll call it purple because it's a little bit of both. Here is another Native American language, actually spoken not far from where I live, in Arizona. It's actually related to languages spoken in the Pueblos in New Mexico. In this language, different linguists have called a different thing. So some call it a passive, some call it an inverse. Now, from our perspective, that's, as I said, that's kind of a pointless debate. The facts are, the patient is in the subject form, so that's what you'd expect for a non-basic voice. The agent is in the oblique form, which you'd also expect for a non-basic voice. The verb, however, is in the basic form. There's no special form, so that's like the basic voice. And then you have this special agreement pattern again. So, again, as I said, trying to call this a passive or an inverse is pointless. Trying to call it a passive or an inverse presupposes that there are universal passive constructions and universal inverse constructions. You should already have the idea at this point, if you've been following the lecture, that in fact there's a lot of different kinds of constructions that vary in many different properties and mix and match properties that I've called basic and non-basic, and even properties that are neither basic or non-basic, these purple properties. So calling this a passive or an inverse is not going to help us a whole lot, because it doesn't tell us how this construction is different from Spanish or Welsh or any of the other languages we've looked at. And in addition, Arizona Tewa has this restriction about the person of the agent and the person of the patient. Now you can see here the passive construction is more extensive, but the important thing to remember is that the basic voice form is always found in the upper right, and the non-basic voice form occurs, describes the situation in the lower left. Other things that have been called inverses. In Maasai, an African language, agent is in the subject case, patient is in the object case. This actually looks like the basic verb form in this language, the basic voice form. The basic verb form, also like the basic voice. However, the verb does not agree with the agent. So that makes it look like a non-basic form. The verb does agree with the patient using special form, so now we have another mixed property. Okay, the Yurok language, spoken in Northwest California, has something that's called a passive. It's used only when third person acting on second person, so that's good. That's the inverse of the ranking in the hierarchy. Agent occurs in the subject form. Well, that looks like a basic voice. Patient occurs in the object form. Also looks like basic voice. Subject, object, verb, word order in this language. However, the verb agrees like a subject with the patient. So not special forms, but just like a basic voice agent, but it agrees with the patient instead. And you have a special verb form, which is called the passive by the analyst. So again, we have a mixture of properties, a different kind of mixture. Now, I'm not going to give you any examples here, because in a language called Chukchi, we actually have four different voice forms. So one we'll call the basic form and three non-basic forms. So the basic forms are what they call the bipersonal forms. What that means is that the verb agrees with agent and patient. There are two different non-basic forms, one with a prefix ine and another with a suffix tku. These form unipersonal forms that are called antipassive. What's important here is that the verb only agrees with one participant. Then there's a prefix that analyzes as an inverse marker. This is the third non-basic voice form. And that prefix can be used as an antipassive if you've got third person acting on third person. So what's interesting here is to look at the distribution of these forms in our little conceptual space. So the bipersonal form is in the upper right. That's the basic form. This inverse form is in the lower left. And then what happens in the middle is much more complicated. The inverse form is used in some places. The bipersonal form is used in some places. And then you have these two other non-basic forms that are used in between. So I've got green, sort of, and brown to indicate those possibilities. Now the thing to observe here is that I'm going to make a couple of comments that will lead me towards the conclusion those of you who heard me talk about parts of speech in Cantonese, bipersonal means that this verb form agrees with both the subject and object. The ability to agree with participants is an example of what's in typological markedness theory we call behavioral potential, as the potential to agree or index arguments, in both arguments. These things in the middle, they have the potential to agree with only one argument. This inverse form has only the behavioral, doesn't have any behavioral potential at all. It doesn't agree. The other thing to note is structural coding. All of these non-basic forms have some kind of overt morpheme that expresses the non-basic verb form. The basic verb form doesn't have such a marking. So this combination here is what we're going to call a typologically unmarked combination. And the extreme case is this combination down in the lower left is a typologically marked combination. And that's, of course, where I'm headed. That's the typological universal that underlies all the diversity of voice forms that we see here. Okay, now there are languages that where linguists have a hard time deciding what to call a non-basic form at all, and what the relationship is between that non-basic form and the basic or active form. A lot of these languages are in the Austronesian language family, spoken in Indonesia, Philippines, and Oceania. Achenese is spoken in Indonesia. So you've got the patient in the subject form, so that looks non-basic. Agent is in an oblique form, so that looks non-basic. The verb agrees with the agent. That looks like a basic verb form, agreeing with the agent. And you have a basic verb form, so that looks like the basic voice. Well, in fact, with this language, there's been a debate about what the correct analysis is. So someone had argued that this is actually a passive voice form, but Mark Dury, who recently did field work on this language, argues that that oblique form has been reinterpreted as an ergative. So in other words, what we're looking at here is a basic voice form with a newly emerged agent form. Newly emerged agent form marked with this prefix that, since it's now interpreted as a prefix marking transitive subjects, Dury calls it an ergative. That's the term that's normally used to describe a grammatical system with a special transitive subject marking. I'll talk more about those on Tuesday. Okay, so we have two alternative analyses. Why do we think that we have these alternative analyses? Well, that's because linguists have reason to believe that this construction might be basic in terms of things like frequency. If you look at some of these Austronesian languages, you'll find that a construction that has a mixture of traits like this actually becomes the more frequent form. So in another Austronesian language, Pukapukan, there is a passive, it looks like Achenese, except the verb form is not basic. The verb form has a passive suffix. But you can drop that passive suffix, and then what you've got is something that looks like the basic verb form if you assume that this transitive subject marking is ergative. And calling it ergative basically means the linguist has decided that this is really the basic verb form, and so it's not an oblique anymore. The agent is the basic form subject, kind of by definition. Here's a language from the Philippines, Kapampangan. The patient is in the subject form. The agent is in the non-subject form. There's no sharp distinction between object and oblique in these languages, so linguists tend to call these non-subject forms. So it kind of looks like the Cree inverse in structural terms again, but still it's non-basic, so we coat it with a warm color. There's a clitic pronoun clitic that agrees with the patient, so that looks like a non-basic verb form. There's a special verb form. But the clitic, this clitic is actually a combination that agrees with the agent with a special form. So it's kind of the mirror image of what we've seen so far, the languages where you have a patient with a special form. So the form that you see here is what's traditionally called in Philippine linguists, by Philippine linguists, is the goal-focused form. Contrast with the actor-focused form, which is the basic form. That's what I use as the reference point for labeling all of these properties of this construction. It's also overtly coded. So again, it's also like the Cree inverse. There happens not to be this hierarchy effect, so I haven't put that in there. So you can see it actually kind of looks like the inverse, though nobody really has said this. The only difference is that it doesn't have that hierarchy of persons governing its use. Now, I have to say a little aside, just like I said, you know, after you start reading a bunch of grammars and you see, well, when people say that a language doesn't have adjectives, what they really mean is that the predicating construction for property words is the same as the predicating construction for action words. Well, when you read a lot of grammars of languages and you see what linguists say when they call something an inverse construction, what they really mean is that there's a non-basic voice construction that's governed by this person hierarchy, whose usage is governed by this person hierarchy. That's kind of in practice what they're saying. But as we've seen, that's not the whole story. Constructions use the person hierarchy in different ways, and the range of structural properties of these non-basic voice constructions is quite wide. But it turns out you can use this framework even to describe something which no one even talks about in terms of basic and non-basic voice. There are a number of languages, and particularly Australian languages, where you have a pattern which typologists call split ergative. Well, I won't explain what it means. I don't think that's the best term to describe it, but I'll show you what the facts are. If you have a sentence like this, "You're hitting me," happens to be second person acting on first person. These first and second person pronouns have special object forms. They're called accusative. If you have a sentence like, "The man is cutting the tree with an axe," so you ever got third person acting on third person, the man gets an ergative form. The tree gets nothing. The tree gets no marking. And that's called absolutive. If you say, "I hit the man," which is third person acting, first person acting on third person, the pronoun has the nominative form. There's no suffix. And the man has the absolutive form. There's no suffix either. If, however, you said, "A man is hitting me," so that's third person acting on first person, the pronoun is me, has the object form, accusative, but the noun also has the ergative form. So basically, pronouns, first and second person pronouns, have special accusative forms. Third person pronouns and common nouns have special ergative forms, special agent forms. So it looks like a complicated pattern. When do you, you know, though it's fairly simple rule, I just described it, about when you use the accusative, when you use the ergative. But what's the effect? And that's on the next page of the slide. The construction that is in the upper right corner has no extra coding. The construction in the lower left corner has the maximum extra coding. Has an ergative case marker on the agent and an accusative case marker on the patient. And then in between you have constructions where you have only one morpheme. Up here you have accusative because you've got a patient that's first or second person. Down here you get the ergative because you have an agent that's third person. So in other words, from the point of view of structural coding, the construction on the upper right has the least structural coding. The construction on the lower left has the most structural coding, and these two constructions in between have an intermediate level of structural coding. So once again, we see this climb, this scale from the upper right down to the lower left in terms of typological markedness, even though in this language it's only in terms of the expression of the participants, the agent and patient coding. The verb doesn't change in any way. So, well, how can we analyze this complexity? Well, here's a color-coded version of what you've got on your slide. You probably can't see half the colors because of using these green and cyan, spring green and cyan, as my computer calls it, in here. But the basic idea is we have, and I'll explain the color coding in a moment. We have a range of languages here. There are more languages on this than I've given you. If you look at chapter 7 of Radical Construction Grammar, you'll see discussion of the missing languages. And what I've done is I've ranged them by looking at the properties of this of the language. So if the patient looks more like a subject, the language goes over to the left. If the patient has special coding, it's in the middle. Patient looks like a direct object, it's over here. Direct object like this, this should be moved over there. And likewise down here, this would be, I don't know how that happened. Agent coding, if it's more subject-like, it's up here. If it's more object-like, it's down here, or oblique-like. It should be oblique-like. This is more direct object-like. I guess I need to fix this slide. But the arrangement here is basically correct. So I said that these languages have kind of mix and match features that we think of as active and direct. So active and direct is in the upper right. That's where agents look like subjects, patients look like objects. That's by definition. And then we see how non-basic instructions in different languages deviate to a greater or lesser extent from this active or basic voice type. And some of them deviate a lot, and others are sort of not so deviant. As I said, I'm not the first person to make this observation, although some typologists agonize over whether a language has a passive or an inverse. Other typologists who have done cross-linguistic surveys of this particular construction don't agonize, they just admit the facts. Anna Siewierska, in her typological study of passives, says, "The analysis of the various constructions referred to in the literature as passive leads to the conclusion that there is not even one single property which all these constructions have in common." Well, she went by constructions that were called passive in the literature, but even if you're more rigorous about defining a non-basic voice construction, you still would come to the same conclusion. Chad Thompson, in his survey of inverse constructions, he was trying to identify an inverse construction type as opposed to the passive, and he basically admitted defeat and said, "I know of no structural features which can define inverse constructions and distinguish them from passives." Matt Shibatani, discussing a paper on passive voice, he's worked a lot on these Philippine languages, these Austronesian languages, so he's aware of the issues with trying to define passive versus active voice, and he concludes that passives form a continuum with active sentences, or constructions, as I would say. So, how can you define a syntactic space? Well, you look at the structural properties of constructions, the contrast between basic voice and non-basic voice in this case. So we came up with things like case marking, indexation, word order, special forms of predicates. Well, we find that they can vary independently of each other. So there's not this cluster like you find in the English passive voice of all of these features that are the opposite of the basic voice features, clustering in one construction, and then all the basic voice features in another, in the basic construction. Cross-linguistically, that's unusual, or it's not universal anyway. You have things that come that are in between. So you have to come up with a way of describing the relationships between these constructions, these different kinds of non-basic voice constructions. So why is this so? That is, this seems to be the way it is empirically. What is the reason for this? The main reason is that language change is gradual. And the fact of the matter is, languages change what voice constructions they have. A non-basic voice construction may increase in use, so increase in frequency. It becomes reanalyzed as the basic voice construction. It changes its form, but it changes its form only gradually. So what does that mean, only gradually? It means it drops one syntactic or structural property at a time. And therefore, if you catch a language family in which new voice constructions are emerging, like the Salishan language family of the northwest coast of America, or the Austronesian language family, you get a lot of diversity and a lot of intermediate voice types. So we have multiple paths of grammatical change that are in there. This is the color coding that corresponds to the examples that were on the syntactic space slide. And you can see there, to the extent that you can read them, what those patterns are. We can look at these, we can plot these gradual change processes in the syntactic space. So you can see one kind of change, another goal-focus to passive, passive to ergative, goal-focus to ergative, passive to inverse, and then this third-person agent form becoming an inverse and then a transitive. They don't all go in the same direction, but a lot of them follow similar paths in the syntactic space. So that gives you some comfort that the syntactic space does reflect sort of gradients and structural properties. So the point here is when we look at grammatical structure, there is a kind of continuum. If you've been listening to Melissa Bowerman's lectures, you will know that looking at the meanings of forms, in her case, verbs and prepositions, also often form a continuum. Think of the cutting and breaking map, and I'll be showing you other maps of this kind on Tuesday. But it's true of the syntax as well. The syntax also can be described in terms of a continuum. So instead of looking at the, you know, properties of spatial relations or the properties of certain kinds of properties like tearing and separation and integration and so on, we're going to look at structural properties of the sentence of the form of a construction. And you can make a space defining the relationships between different constructions just as you can make a space defining the relationships between different kinds of actions or spatial relations. So syntactic space, so we have a syntactic space. Well, it's actually systematically related to that conceptual space. As I've been saying over and over again, basic voice constructions are always associated with higher animacy agent acting on a lower animacy patient, and derived voice constructions or non-basic voice constructions with lower animacy agent acting on a higher animacy patient. Animacy constraints are really a conventionalized version of salience or topicality constraints. So that's the sense in which the Givens functional definition of a passive, or more accurately, a non-basic voice is one where the patient is more topical than the agent, or at least in the prototypical sense. And this point's been made by Chad Thompson and Ann Koraman, a couple of functional typological linguists. So if we map the conceptual space onto the syntactic space, the agent coding represents a continuum between the more salient agents, which are going to look more subject-like, and the to being less salient agents, being more oblique-like. Remember that should say oblique down here. And then absent. So there are many languages where in the non-basic voice form you cannot express the agent at all. The same is true for the patient coding. So the patient coding is more salient, then it's going to be more subject-like, and then as we go down to less subject-like, it is less salient, and it can also be absent. This actually reflects another family of voice constructions, the ones that typologists call anti-passive constructions, which I did not explore in this study. But those would be, that would push the space off in the direction off the right-hand side of the screen to constructions where the patient is actually absent. It's lower salient or lower in salience or absent. So my conclusions. So syntactic properties form a syntactic space that should be analyzed in the same way as a conceptual space. I'm kind of anticipating here because I haven't shown you how to analyze conceptual space, but basically the way that you've been shown by Melissa Bowerman. And I will talk about this more on Tuesday, than the lectures on Tuesday. Constructions are made up of a combination of syntactic properties. No particular combination of syntactic properties represents a universal construction type. But the cross-linguistic distribution of syntactic properties correlates with dimensions of conceptual space. In particular, the voice construction that has the least structural coding and the most behavioral potential will indicate a more topical agent acting on a less topical patient, and the construction with the greater structural coding and with the limited behavioral potential will represent the inverse relation of a less topical agent acting on a more topical patient. So that's the kind of pattern we find in this particular domain. This kind of way of looking at syntactic constructions is actually fairly new to typologists. As I said, a lot of typologists are still trying to decide, you know, assume that you can identify universal construction types in formal terms. But this sort of study I've given you, which I think of as a example of how a radical construction grammarian would analyze a particular linguistic construction, should, I hope, point the way to analyses that will respect the structural diversity of constructions in the world's languages. Thank you.